March 16th. We're going to start today with a little informational presentation regarding toll roads and House Bill 3090 from last session. And if Doug Tindall will come and share the information, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Starr, members of the committee, I'm Doug Tindall, maintenance engineer for the Department of Transportation. I'm here to talk about House Bill 3090 from last session. House Bill 3090 had two components to it, and I will talk about them separately. One thing that the bill required us to do was an innovative look at building a freeway-like facility in eastern Oregon. And the intention, I believe, behind this was if you build a free, kind of a build it and they will come idea that would promote growth in eastern Oregon and possibly be somewhat of a solution to some of the congestion in western Oregon. The second part of House Bill 3090 is a required a toll analysis on modernization projects, and I will address that in a second. The results of the study on of the Eastern Oregon Freeway, the feasibility study of the Eastern Oregon Freeway, were not intuitively obvious, at least not intuitively obvious to me. I've got some folks here who can go into the details about how this works, but let me briefly describe the process. There are models, modeling tools, it's a canned software, if you will, that we load data into, and it crunches its number for some, or crunches for some period of time, and spits out numbers telling you what traffic volumes and growth rates and so forth will be under different scenarios of geometrics and speed of highways. We looked at three distinct options. We looked at one option that basically follows Highway US 395 down from I-82, which runs Pendleton, John Day, Burns, and into Lakeview. And then we looked at another the other two options. Both utilized the route of US 97, one of them in its entirety, all the way from the Washington border to the California border, and just improved that road to freeway-type standards. The second angled across from about where I-82 meets I-84, a little bit west of Pendleton, and angled across to in the Madras vicinity, and then followed 97 down. So that was a new alignment that cut across over there. The results showed, and they had to explain this to me three times, and I'll tell you what finally got me to go, ah, I see. The results showed that improving US 97 will stimulate growth in Central Oregon, but it will also stimulate more growth in the Willamette Valley. The reason for this is that businesses tend to go to established economic centers. And what finally got me to, and it's a complex kind of a set of things that make that happen. But what finally woke me up to believe that, okay, I guess this could be possible, is when we looked at the building of I-5 in Southern Oregon. What happened when we built I-5 in Southern Oregon was, now you have a freeway-like facility in Southern Oregon, and it did indeed stimulate growth in Southern Oregon, but the growth was not as fast as the growth in the Willamette Valley, the Eugene North area. So what's happening apparently is that the businesses wanting to go to where there's a current economic center will use, if it's easier, if we open up a channel that makes it easier for them to get there, and opening up 97 would make it a little bit quicker for them to get there, they would tend to go to the Willamette Valley, is what the analysis shows.
Representative Devlin, that
what you're saying there is that by opening up 97, you would improve traffic flow in the I-5 corridor, thus making it more more attractive.
No, you would improve flow in the 97 corridor, making it easier to get to the Willamette Valley. In other words, if you improve up to Highway 58, if you improve the road up to 58, it makes it easier to use Highway 97, 58, Oregon 58 is the one that runs from Chemult across to Eugene. And so people would you would increase traffic along those routes in their attempt to get to the Willamette Valley. The Eastern Oregon portion of the freeway didn't have the same effect, but it also didn't show that it radically changed the growth pattern in Eastern Oregon. In fact, it appears that the potential of that freeway creating growth, the US 395 route creating growth, is dependent largely on the overall economy of not just Eastern Oregon, but the Eastern Washington and the California-Nevada area. And then, in fact, it's possible by improving US 395, we may actually promote growth in the other states rather than promoting it in Oregon. Pasco Kennewick is somewhat of an economic center already, as is Spokane, and so it's possible that if we opened up a more attractive channel through Eastern Oregon, that growth may in fact go out of the state. Although our analysis only pertained to Oregon, so we can't say that for sure. So the basic conclusion
is that you improve 395, do you take any traffic, any congestion, anything out of I-5 that quarter?
And the analysis didn't indicate that changed the growth pattern in the Willamette Valley.
And you're comfortable with that the analysis that you used is good, up to standards?
It's as good as
you can get? Or
we can have Brian Greger come up and talk about the model, but I think it's as good a model as exists out there today. I used to do this stuff a long time ago, but my hair was a different color. And then
longer?
Thank you. And the modeling tools have improved significantly since when I was using them, and they weren't bad. You know, we went back at least. When I was doing it, we went back and validated them every once in a while. They weren't too far off. They usually came out pretty close. And I would assume now, 20 years later, they're probably a lot better. So our conclusion on the Eastern Oregon Freeway is, you know, the cost we were looking at was $1 billion-plus kind of investment. Every one of those routes has concerns, environmental concerns, as well as geographic concerns going over hills and around or through mountains, or it would not be easy to build any of those roadways, so they all carry a high price tag, although we didn't go into great detail to figure out how much they cost. It's in that billion-plus area.
Billion-plus, like around a billion, or a billion-plus up to 2 billion, or?
I'd say a billion to a billion and a half.
And you compare that to how much did they spend on the West Side Light Rail? Almost $1 billion. Okay, go on.
Point well taken, Mr. Chair.
I wasn't... didn't know it was that high, but I'll take your word for it.
$987 million.
Okay. The conclusion, we can't tell that it would that sort of investment would do what the original thought of the innovative idea of an Eastern Oregon Freeway would actually wind up doing what it was going to do.
Kind of like Westside Light Rail reducing congestion on Highway 26. You can continue. I'm sorry with the editorial comment.
Mr. Chair, don't kill the messenger, okay?
I understand. Thank you, Rick.
I won't speculate whether the congestion would be worse on US 26 if they didn't have West Side Light Rail or not, knowing that it is still bad and that I avoid it at all costs.
There you go.
Mr. Chair.
Ever some crap.
Please help this poor, feeble farmer's mind understand how the latest modeling tools suggest it might create more growth in the Willamette Valley by building a freeway. Just seems to really defy logic to me. Can you enlighten me? Help me out here.
Chair Star, please. Representative Krupp, I can just go back and describe again the situation when they built I-5 in Southern Oregon. What happened was that growth did occur in the Southern Oregon as a result of I-5, but growth was faster in the Portland area, even with I-5 improved through Southern Oregon. So what it appears is that traffic wants to use the easiest way possible to get to established economic centers. And then if you approve 97, you have an easier way to get to an established economic center, and that growth will tend to occur more in that area than it would in the areas through which the improved facility runs.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So your supposition is then that you're using a model from the early 1960s, in essence, when the freeway system was built, I-5 was built, and its resulting effect in some years since that. Are you saying then that you're saying there is more growth that would occur potentially in other economic centers than what would occur in Central Oregon? But you're not saying that substantial growth wouldn't occur in Central Oregon.
Chair Starr, Representative Krupp, that's correct. Although the growth isn't substantial, the final report will have the numbers in it. But the numbers that we looked at we're talking about in single digit percentages, and I think in every case less than 5. That this structure would make really a minor difference, although it would promote some growth. And you stated it exactly correctly. Growth would occur in those areas at a faster rate than it occurs without the improvement. However, not as fast as it occurs in the economic center areas.
Hey, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Since the inception of, and you're using the example of Southern Oregon when I-5 was built, and that's what I'm keying on here.
Okay.
And if you have something else to share with me, please do. But if you're going to compare that, I think you're comparing apples to oranges, and here's why. Is because since the time of I-5 and in the ensuing years, we've had a shift in thinking about where people want to live in this state. We have growth and congestion problems in the Willamette Valley. We have businesses that would like to locate for quality of life reasons outside of the Willamette Valley and are trying to make choices to do just exactly that. And some of the economic growth that's occurred in Redmond around the airport and their enterprise zones and so on and so forth. We've also had folks that a massive shift, as we have seen, of people who want to move into Oregon for a lot of reasons. And the places they want to move are not necessarily the Willamette Valley. So what I'm saying is yes, your model was based on what happened historically, but I would suggest to you that you might rethink your model in terms of there's a changing attitude out there now, and it seems like a lot of folks want to retire and want to settle in Central Oregon.
Chair Starr, Representative Krupp, let me clear this up. A little bit. The model that we're using is not based on what happened on I-5. It was only when they explained to me what happened with I-5 that I started to believe that the results of the model could be true. So the modeling tool is not a generic modeling tool used throughout the country, and it's not based on any particular occurrence of what happened on I-5. All I was saying was that I was right where you are. Until we got to the third time when they explained it to me, and they used that as the example, and I said, okay, I guess I can see what you mean. But I certainly understand where you're coming from. It is not intuitive that would be the answer that would come out of doing a project like this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Any other questions? Continue, Doug.
Thanks. We'll move on to the toll potential analysis. And the final report of the toll analysis is included in the back of my testimony. There are a couple things one major thing about this analysis is that we only considered the direct financial results of tolling a project. There are other issues that you need to look at in determining whether a project has toll potential, such as time savings, public acceptance, land use impacts, the tolling method, and air quality. So we did look at the projects in the 2000-2003 STIP and the projects that would have been approved as part of Measure 82 had that passed, and found 6 projects that might reasonably be tolled. I should tell you the basic criteria is that tolling projects usually need to be somewhat access controlled or be a bridge. Those are the two that where it's practical. If you don't have control, it's pretty hard to toll people. So that's kind of the filter we used and found 6 projects that might reasonably include tolls. One was a new route, four added lanes, and one was a bridge. And those are shown on page two of my testimony at the very bottom.
Which are the new projects?
The West Eugene Parkway.
That's the new project?
That's the new project. Is that right? Yeah. Yes. The others are adding lanes.
Okay, thanks.
Three of the six appeared to have potential to pay. And this is a little bit unclear as we were discussing before the hearing, so I'm going to, the first paragraph on page three, let me, if I can, clarify somewhat. Three appeared to have potential to use tolls to pay their costs, and that includes their construction as well as operating and maintenance costs. One could not be, was not expected to generate enough revenue to even pay operating maintenance. Two others didn't generate enough revenue to pay for construction, but did appear that they may be able to generate enough revenue to pay for operating and maintenance costs. And those two are the two that are listed at the bottom, the West Eugene Parkway and the Eastgate Bridge in Pendleton. Again, the important thing here is that this is based on the financial analysis and doesn't include those other factors as far as public acceptance, and so there's much further analysis that would need to be done that will occur as these projects move forward in the STIP.
Did you only consider projects that were in the STIP for tolling?
STIP and the Major 82 bond list.
Okay, so any other proposed conceptual road, i.e. the West Side Bypass, did not have any consideration?
No. So that may as well, you know, if we look at those, West Side Bypass, from what I know about it, would be access controlled enough. It probably has that, would fit that general screen of something you could look at tolling. The toll analysis also showed that whole facility tolling, in other words, tolling the whole a new project, the West Side Bypass or West Eugene Parkway, has greater potential to pay for the costs than the what's called the hot lane concept, the high occupancy toll concept. If I was in Ways and Means, that would have cost me a quarter. Can't use acronyms down there. The hot lane concept, the projects that the highway segments that were evaluated for the hot lane concept would be able to pay a small portion of the construction costs. But it looks like the whole facility tolling is in this analysis would be the one that has a larger potential. And as I said, the toll is attached. And we presented that to the Oregon Transportation Commission, and the commission continues to use that as prescribed in the law as a criteria for evaluating projects.
Mr. Chair?
Just one second. I'm a little bit disappointed in this report, to be real honest with you.
Okay.
You know, you look at different jurisdictions around the country that rely heavily on tolling facilities, and it seems to work relatively well to not only pay for maintenance and preservation of the facility, but also the construction of the same, where you have significant private investment willing to come up with capital to build these facilities. And yet, here, you look at the STIP and you only find six projects that maybe might even work and won't even pay for the whole thing. I'd like to know why. What's wrong with this picture? Why does it seem to work in California, for instance, SR 5091? Or roads in the east, and are we that different in Oregon? Or is our terrain that different? Are our costs that much more? Is the environmental impact regulations that much more than other states?
Chair Starr, no, I don't think so. I think that it was the list of projects from which we selected. I think that you cited the West Side Byway or the West Side Bypass, which we didn't evaluate. We looked at projects that were sort of feasibly on the radar screen as far as doable. So we weren't looking at the whole gamut of projects. It's just that of those we looked at, And it was 3 out of 6 that we looked at, you know, that had that toll potential. 3 of them said, yeah, you could pay for some construction costs. We also didn't add in that factor, those other factors about private contribution and trying to build a consortium of people to build a road. But I don't think that that the report is inconsistent with what you're saying. It says that whole facility tolling, which is what those were, is the best way to go. It's just that we don't have we didn't have that many brand new roads identified. It's probably why this came out that way.
Okay, all right, Representative Kirk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To get us where I know that in my conversations with the chair and others. We would like to think outside the box in the future as to how to build new transportation systems in this state. And having said that, what would it take, in your opinion, for ODOT to give us cost comparisons and studies in regard to some of the new techniques that are being used out there in terms of pavement leasing? Where you you allow a contractor to come in, design, build a product, and the state leases it, and they guarantee the pavement for 20, 30 years, whatever you come up with, and the state pays them a lease payment every year. Some of the more innovative things that are being tried around the country and appear to be fairly successful, do we need to pass legislation having ODOT do that, or can we request it and you can put it into your study potential for the coming biennium? What would be your best direction on that, Doug?
Chair Starr, Representative Krupp, we're actually thinking about those things all the time. I think that we have, I believe it's House Bill 2301, which is the alternative financing bill that creates that Blue Ribbon Task Force to look at other types of financing, but I think that it rolls into not just a vehicle mile tax kind of concept, which was, I think, the way it initially came out, but I think that there are amendments that expand that to cover all of those other options. The other things that I'll tell you, there's a one of our guys up in Portland is, and there's some folks down here in Salem as well that are really up to speed on all of the potential options that are out there. We're sort of stuck right now in terms of having enough money to. I see this as being a private, federal government, state government, maybe local government consortium of people moving in that may provide some funding with the private contractor like you're thinking of. I've seen those roads. They work really well. And so I think that's out there. But we're not financially can't figure out exactly how to move there yet. Studies like – or bills like House Bill 2301, creating committees like that are going to help move us forward. I'd also say that the area commissions on transportation, in my belief, are going to help us get there because now we're bringing more people to the table at the local level that really promote that kind of thinking and that kind of discussion, not only within the area commission at the Oregon Transportation Commission, but also with the legislature and with Congress. And I think that it's kind of a multi-legged stool, not three-legged or four-legged, but a whole bunch of legs that's going to enable us to move forward to be able to do this.
And Mr. Chair, one last question.
Yes, please.
I have recently introduced legislation that requires the state to build additional lanes on I-5 between Salem and Eugene. Partly because of an issue that we've discussed previously in this committee, and that is the current ongoing work between Albany and Salem and how that the federal government is requiring us to remove the fill work at some point in time, which, again, seems to defy a bit of logic. Will that be my intention for asking you the previous question about pavement leasing concepts and hot lanes and you know, things that are available, especially in light of that we have this new technology emerging, which we may need to consider in regards to GPS transponders that are able to be programmed to track your time and where you're driving and do congestion pricing and all of these things that I think have some potential for us to look at as we have to review how we're financing Oregon's roads. So what's important to me that if we move forward with that legislation and we look at providing some type of lanage, what's the easiest way we could build it? Would that be perhaps through a pavement leasing concept? Could it be the state that does it? How can we put that together? In other words, what innovative and creative ways would you come up with should we be successful in that legislation? And would that legislation, that's a two-part question, would that legislation be helpful to you in terms of going to the federal government and saying, we now have state law that says we're going to have to do this. Can we leave that fill in there and utilize it?
Chair Merkley, Representative Krupp, let me answer the second question first. I don't know that I think what would carry more weight at federal level would be the constituency going back to our delegation saying, hey, we need this. We need federal dollars to do this. The issue, if that bill passed, we would have to figure out how we were going to do it. Well, what does that mean to us right now? We have limited authority to toll in current Oregon law. So we've got that problem. It's not clear how within our I'm not saying that we can't do it. I think we can, but it's not clear how within our procurement laws we would go about building that structure where you would have somebody come in and collect the tolls on it and make their money back that way, in addition to collecting some annual fee from us, which is probably easier than us coming up with a chunk of money in the first place. But if you pass that law, then we would have to go out and find the money somewhere, and we would approach the federal delegation, and we would look within our own step to find other money, which means some projects are going to slip or fall out. So,
well, that would, of course, depend on what method of financing for the construction were to be considered.
Right.
If you're looking at a pavement leasing concept with the potential of using tolling, then but I would think that would require very little input in terms of actual expenditure by ODOT.
Pierce, our Representative Krupp, I think we have to every one of these projects like this would require an analysis to figure out what the ODOT commitment would have to be, and I can't tell you right away, but conceptually you're right. Yep. Anything you do along those lines requires less upfront investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Representative Berger?
Yes. My first question is the West Eugene Parkway, is that a go, approved plan by the City of Eugene?
Chair Starr, Representative Verger, no. I believe the city approved a portion of the West Eugene Parkway, and the question that arose at the last Transportation Commission meeting is, does what the city approved benefit the state system enough to make it a state project, or should it become a local project? But as it stands right now, the city council has not approved that complete project.
I guess it troubles me a little bit that you even bothered to, you've already spent a lot of money on the parkway, and so to spend more, I don't mean this as a criticism, but as an observation, to spend more to put them into the toll road discussion seems a little bit not exactly maybe appropriate.
Chair Starr, Representative Verger, if I may, the toll road report was written in actually last year.
Oh, was it?
We went into the STIP. And so at the time, it was a project that we felt.
That you really felt had a green light. Oh, all right. That explains that. Thank you. I'm glad to know that, because otherwise it would seem strange to me that with the, you know, we have a little bit of the same situation in my district there at the intersection of 126, I believe it is, and at Florence and 101, where now you've spent all kinds of time planning, and local entities are saying, well, you know, maybe this isn't going to work, and so forth. And this is very unfortunate, because your time is very, very valuable, particularly to people like us on this committee. that are see the money being spent. I guess the other thing I'm a little disappointed is that it's not as creative. I don't know why, but for some reason I was looking at maybe a concept of going up and over I-5 with the second freeway that would be tolled. Those kinds of things. The main thing to me with the traffic flow is that you get people from A to B. You took a lot into consideration of growth, and I think that, of course, it would be nice if we would grow on the coast, but we do need a highway, a better road than we have, getting people over to the coast for the weekend, a safer road getting over to the weekend. Not so much for the growth of the regular population. So I'm a little disappointed in that. I'd like to have seen some concepts of where it would be possible to get people from the valley over to the coast for the weekend. Also, maybe going up and over I-5 all the way along as a toll road.
Chair Starr, Representative Verger, again, I think that's similar to Chair Starr's question, is that we only looked at the projects that were actually identified. We didn't go out and develop another list of projects. And as you've pointed out, that's a tenuous balance, because if you go out and you start saying, well, I'm going to point down a road from Albany to Depot Bay, some people get upset that you're thinking about doing that when you haven't even talked to them yet. So it's a real tenuous balance. If we like to have a project that's been out there and been talked about in the public before we go out and say we're thinking about doing something that might impact people.
Okay, even if it's just creative ideas?
Well, Chair Starr, Representative Verger, I believe someone spoke to the director the other day about doing something very similar to what you're talking about a tollway, like a four-lane tollway to the coast from the valley, it just as a discussion point. But again, it's
one from the legislature?
I don't know where he heard that.
Sorry to interrupt.
I understand what you're saying, and we could have we could probably go out and look at toll potential on a whole bunch of innovative ideas in a whole bunch of different parts of the state, but in order to rein in the scope somehow, we did it only on the identified projects. So, but I understand what you're saying.
Thank you.
Representative Devlin.
I just wanted to echo his concerns about that, because I've been involved in several corridor-level studies, and what's really nice is when you do a corridor-level study, and you see the maps, and we're not talking about a specific alignment, we're talking about a corridor. And we've got this huge swath.
Sounds like the West Side Bypass to me.
One of them. I've been involved in more than one. And this huge swath is, in some cases, 5 miles wide, you know, in some cases, maybe a little bit wider. And when members of the public that happen to be in that swath see the map, sometimes you want to make sure that you've done the public process before that, so that they don't react in droves, so to speak, in protest.
What? A lop off your head?
Sometimes, yeah.
Representative Zahner.
Mr. Chair, can I ask, Doug, did you check with the public before you put that a piece of concrete in front of Hilliard's there that we're thinking of removing? Can you answer that one?
Chair Starr, Representative Zahner, understanding with the median barrier on 214 was that there was, as the development went in, there was a plan that was going to occur at some time or another. Whether that was a public plan or an agreement with the developer is not clear to me.
Thank you.
Are you complete on your testimony?
Yes, I am.
Is there any other questions for Doug or anyone else? Thank you very much.
Oh, wait. Yes. Doug, how much did the? Can you tell me how much a study like these cost? What's it cost?
Free.
I don't know. Do we track it? We can get that number to you. I can tell you it cost Brian a little bit of sleep and some hair, but I can get you the number of what.
More specifically, like a study to build a freeway in through eastern Oregon, how much does that cost?
Well, we'll run that down. Ryan did it, and we'll figure out on how much we spent doing it to this level. I don't have a number for you right now, but we'll get you one.
I only have 3 freeways that I want to build in the state. I'll tell you about them later.
Have you talked to the public? Never mind.
I'm on the internet, so I'm sure my phone will ring. Thanks, Doug, very much for your testimony.
Yeah.
With that, we will go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 298. And, John, do you want to talk about that bill, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Starr, members of the committee. You have before you Senate Bill 298 that repeals the requirements that Oregon Department of Transportation suspend driver license of person under 18 years of age that commits a specified offense. It repeals separate provision for a driver improvement program for persons under 18 years of age. Also creates a provision that ODOT may adopt rules regarding driver improvement programs, including rules creating programs for persons under 18 years of age. It authorizes programs for persons not granted driving privileges, declares an emergency and effective on passage, delays operation until January 1st, 2002, except for adoption of rules by ODOT. As you see by the summary, there is no revenue impact on this bill. You should have a copy of the fiscal statement issued. This bill is also has a subsequent referral to waiver. Thank you, Chair.
So this bill came from the Senate, and it came to the House, and then we're going to send it to Ways and Means from here.
Yes.
One way to go. Kelly Taylor is on the sign-up sheet. Today it looks like it's going to be the Kelly Taylor.
Yeah, no.
We were happy about that.
Hope that's okay.
Quite all right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation, and this was one of the bills that the department asked the governor to submit for us. What we're trying to do is increase driver safety through reduced convictions and accidents by teen drivers and also unlicensed drivers. And I want to explain a little bit about the driver improvement program and how it works between adults and teens. And I know you've all heard about the teen driver law from last session, which really beefed up and strengthened the front end of the licensing process for teens to try to make sure that they had lots of practice and very, very careful practice even after they get their license with, you know, few passengers and things like that. What this bill is aimed at is beefing up and strengthening the back end of the teen licensing program, which is after they get their license and they start getting tickets and being involved in accidents, to address that quickly and intervene to try to get them to reduce that risk-taking behavior and everything and get them to be safer drivers. For years, there has been rule authority to put together a driver improvement program for adults. This is where we, through the public process of rulemaking, identify convictions and accidents and the sequence of such. When you get them, you would receive letters from us. This is when your activities are higher than the average driver. So you would get a letter telling you that you're better than average, but not necessarily in a great way. telling you that you're getting more tickets and accidents than the average driver and we're concerned. And eventually, depending on the activity on your record, you could actually end up with a suspended driver's license. We try not to do that. We try to have you come in and meet with a counselor and try to figure out what's going on, why you're getting these tickets, why the accidents are happening, and see if we can't come up with some sort of solution. Typically, it's for the person to take some sort of defensive driver class or something like that to teach them a little bit more about space between them and the car in front of them, following distance and things like that. When the teen driver law was very first implemented in Oregon back in the 80s, they did come up, the legislature did come up with a modified driver improvement program that they've actually put in statute. And I've tried to check the archives to find out exactly what was the thinking, and nobody's really sure. It's too far back. But the teen driver law, for some reason, only counts convictions. Accidents are not part of the formula. And yet young drivers are 7 times more likely to be in an accident than older drivers. So we're concerned. We believe that convictions and accidents, watching both of those, is an important thing at getting at helping someone improve their driving. The sooner you can get at them and talk to them and counsel them, the better off you're going to be to try to change the behavior and perhaps avoid future accidents and convictions. So what we've asked in this bill is to allow us, and the other thing that's with the program that's in rule, the way it's structured, teens are actually getting many tickets and still only being, depending on the timing and how they come in between the courts and us and everything, the timing, actually staying at the very first step of the program, getting multiple tickets. And what we would like to do is model the teen driver law to include accidents and convictions and be able to structure that bill by rule. So as we do studies and as we tell what is working and what isn't working and being effective, we have the flexibility to adjust that. And we would like to include unlicensed teens and adults, be able to help them become legal drivers and help them become better drivers also. Now, the bill does have a fiscal impact because we would see more teens. There would be more activity. And that's our point. We think there's a lot of teens out there that are falling between the cracks and nobody's talking to them about it. It is part of our budget, and so I want you to know that. It was very heavily supported on the Senate. In fact, it came out of the Senate Transportation, General Government Transportation with a unanimous vote, and it was unanimous on the floor. So I would ask the committee to support the bill so that we can help the teens become safer drivers faster.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Questions, Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Repeal separate provision for driver improvement program for persons under 18 years of age. Why didn't that work?
Mr. Chair and Representative Honor, what's in statute doesn't include accidents. It only is convictions. And the way that it's structured, it talks about if you were twice previously convicted. And what happens is if you were to get two tickets on the same day, if you were a teenager and you got two tickets two different times during the day, like one in the morning and one in the afternoon, they're not counted as separate. They're counted as the same incident. You're able to rack up lots of tickets just by the way it's structured. And so what we want to be able to do is include convictions and accidents and structure it so that we can not have you falling between the cracks, so to speak, and intervene a little sooner for you.
Follow up? So we're still letting them drive with convictions and accidents. When do we pull the licenses here?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's just it. We want to be able to get at it quicker. You're right. They're able to get multiple convictions and not even hear from us or hear from anyone. And it's been beneficial in some cases. We find it's beneficial once we get them into the program. And that's what we want to do. We want to get them in the program sooner. And unfortunately, that does mean more workload, and it does have an FTE impact, and that will be up to Ways and Means to decide whether they fund it or tell us to absorb it or what to do, but we want to put it forth because we think it's important. We think that it's worth the effort and the money to try to save some lives, and both theirs and other people that are out on the road with them, quite frankly.
Representative Berger.
I don't understand the program, Kelly.
Okay.
So could you explain to me how you work the program? What does it entail?
You bet. Mr. Chair and Representative Berger. With an adult, I'm going to talk to the driver adult program first, just because it's more the model that we know works, but I'll also talk teen. What happens is we have the system program to watch for certain convictions. They've been identified. Okay, these convictions count in the program. So when a certain number of those convictions in a certain time period, say 2 and 6 months or 2 and a year type of thing, show up on your record, a letter is generated. Currently, a letter is generated to you. And if you were to get, and it would tell you that you have, that we're concerned, you know, the letter tells you that we're concerned because tickets are an indication that, you know, there's possibly some dangerous behavior out there, and it puts you at risk and others at risk, et cetera. And use a little pamphlet about the driver improvement program is included. And it's telling you that if you continue to get tickets, and in the case of adult accidents in a certain time period, that we could be considering to suspend your license, and we'd call you in for a counseling session with a driver improvement counselor. And the purpose of that, and then if you did continue to get tickets or accidents as an adult, you would end up at a counseling session. And we would talk to you and find out, you know, perhaps we would discover that, you know, you didn't realize, as we look at the kinds of tickets you're getting, you didn't realize that following too close and the 2-second rules and things like that, you don't even have that comprehension, so that's what's causing you to rear end people or get the following too close tickets or things like that, and you don't understand that that's why that's important to hang back a little bit. So we would recommend that you go to, require you to go to, say, a defensive driving class. And then upon completion of that class, then we would just continue to monitor the record. If you continue to get tickets, we will suspend you. So the point of the driver improvement program, as quoted in statute, is the goal to reduce the risk of accidents, to improve driver safety by the reducing accidents and convictions. And that's the goal of the program. So what we do is we have the system monitor your driving record, and at certain intervals, depending on the activities on your record, generate a letter to you, generate a letter telling you to come into a counseling session, generating a suspension order if that need be. And with the teen program, it's only looking at convictions. It's not counting accidents at all. So a teen could be in 3 and 4 accidents, nothing would happen.
Follow up, please.
And let me just answer that, and then you can follow up. But in the event that they're in an accident, generally there's a citation written in an accident.
Mr. Chair, it depends. Not all accidents have a conviction.
Not all.
Yeah, and in fact, I would have to look to see how many truly do. Police aren't always called out to the scene of an accident. In fact, we only get a police report on about 30% of all accidents.
From personal experience, I've found that, not that I was a driver in some accidents, but
right.
I've been in several accidents for whatever reason. I think 70% of the time, the driver was cited in those accidents.
Okay.
So when you refer to a program, you're really referring mostly to communication.
Correct.
By mail with the individual.
Mr. Chair and Representative Verger, that is the very first step, yes. And after that, it's face-to-face.
Okay. I guess the only problem that I have with this is that you have laws, and we are to obey laws, and there seems to be a lot of hand-holding to me. If I'm constantly running into people in the back end of their vehicle, very likely I'm not only following too close, I'm probably driving too fast, or I'm talking on a cell phone. And so I think that... I think there's a lot of hand-holding here. Let me switch to the teen program, which interests me more, and that is with the schools eliminating driver ed and so forth in some places because of lack of funding, has there been an effort for the Department of Transportation to work in partnership with the schools at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, in partnership with them to do what? I'm sorry.
To instruct teens under the age of 18, those without driver's license, in better safety standards and so forth?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I will say that we have partnerships with the schools to proctor testing for us. We also have a bill that you all approved that would help us expand who can instruct and test by allowing us to use private companies to do that, since sometimes in the rural areas the school has cut back on that program.
Right.
So yes, we have done some partnering with the schools trying to, you know, have them help the teens become licensed, and part of that is understanding, of course, the rules of the road as they're giving the test. And with the private companies being able to not only do the driver's education, but also in some cases be able to do the test for us. That was a bill that you all helped me pass, and it's over at the Senate side. I'm trying to get a hearing over there for that very reason.
Just a note of interest. We're going to have a informational meeting on House Bill 2440, I believe it was last session, that set up these Well, what we did is we authorized ODOT to set up a bunch of rules to strengthen the testing requirements in the schools and all this stuff. Just created a little bit of controversy that we'll get to revisit. And that's scheduled for the 26th, I think. So that just give us another part of that picture. Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Can you give me a diagram, a breakdown? You know, when the teen gets so many tickets, then you contact him. So many convictions, and can you diagram that out, you know, show me the step-by-step? You don't have to do it now, but get me a diagram that I can understand.
Yes.
So I want some specifics to know when we finally decide that this person should be taken off of the road or whatever.
Mr. Chair and Representative Donner, yes, I'd be happy to do that. And I will tell you that also in this bill, after we had it submitted, this also will help us comply by doing it by rule with some of the Attorney General's review of proper use of highway funds and some of the programs that they call when you have progressive what they call, you know, some people have referred to as progressive discipline, I suppose. We are to take action sooner, not to do so much of the, as Representative Bridger called it, hand-holding and sending out just courtesy letters, is to get at action sooner. So, Representative, I'd be happy to show you both today's world and what we're proposing for tomorrow's world under this bill.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
finances is going to bother me again, not only the computer, so I want you to get as specific as you can, because
mm-hmm.
I just feel you may be trying to create another program that's going to cost us money that still isn't going to be effective if we don't enforce it, if we don't take these licenses or make these people come in, and you know where I'm getting at.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Honor, and that's exactly what the new program will be to take the license, probably at the first step. They may get it back under sort of a probationary period. It is to act swiftly and not to do the advisory letters anymore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? No? Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 298. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3064. And, John, will you give us an overview of 3064, please?
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 3064 eliminates payment of motor vehicle funds fee when obtaining or renewing driver license, and this bill declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2001. Should mention, as we introduce this bill, that we have several bills in the next few weeks, committee members, dealing with the Attorney General's issuance of the letter of guidance at the end of this end of January that issued positions on 48 programs within ODOT as far as the improper use of the AG interprets as the improper use of state highway trust funds. This is one of those first bills that's trying to remedy this particular program. You have a statement that shows no, or you have a notice of no revenue impact on this bill, and you should be receiving the fiscal statement for you that we just received. Should commend our fiscal office in particular. We just received the information to compile this at 6 o'clock last night and just really crafted this morning. A couple things would probably draw your attention to on the fiscal statement as you receive it, members.
Thank you.
Is $52,000 for 2001 and 2003. That figure in your comments explains that amount of money. It's based on the assumption that 50% of the renewals, while this bill is in transition, and 50% of the renewals received by DMV for the first 3 months of this biennium will include the discontinued fees for the dealing with the rating area. This bill is not anticipated by the governor's budget. However, the governor's office, as well as Ways and Means, is very much aware of this issue. Thank you, Chair Starr.
Thank you. Kelly.
Again, Mr. Chair, Kelly Theodore from the Department of Transportation. Members, John has done an excellent job of explaining it. It is something that the Attorney General has told us needs to be discontinued. It isn't so much the collecting of the fee, it's the fact that we distribute the fee off to something other than the state highway fund that's the problem. And the fee is known as the Motor Vehicle Accident Fund fee, or MVAF. It's been around for many, many, many years. I believe it went on the books back in the 40s, if not late 40s, early 50s. Right now, it's collected when you get your first-time original license, like you just moved to Oregon or your team for the first time. Getting your license, or when you're renewing a license. The fee is $4 if you're on a four-year license. We are still renewing some people through the mail at 4 years as we transition to the eight-year license. Or it's $8 when you get an eight-year driver's license, either first time or renewal. And the fees are transferred off to Adult and Family Services Division of Department of Human Services to pay basically hospitals and various health care providers who supplied care to an indigent patient that was injured in a motor vehicle accident and is unable to pay, and they're unable to collect, et cetera. And they, you know, so it's helping to offset some of that. It certainly doesn't cover all their costs, I'm sure. And so we're just simply not allowed to do that. That's improper use of the highway funds to collect money and then as the as a tax, you know, and then hand it off to somebody else. We're not allowed to do that. And so it does have an emergency clause, so we can stop this in July. And as John explained, there will be, you know, some workload associated with that transition. Renewal notices go out to people early, and so it'll take a little bit of time to get it all changed around.
Any questions? Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I realize this is one of the fees that's been identified by the Attorney General as an inappropriate use of highway fund dollars. We probably have a number of alternatives here, and I know that you've got a work group that's been going, but if you lower this fee but then don't raise some of the other fees, you actually potentially end up with less dollars in terms of what's actually going to improvement.
So we have the opportunity to actually leave this fee, the amount of money on the license, and allow the $8 or $4 to stay in the state highway fund, perhaps potentially then not raising the list of fees that are in House Bill 2139.
Right. I'm just trying to find out where the chair is going from here with the bill.
I don't intend to move the bill today.
One small portion of a huge huge complex web.
One small step.
I don't intend to move this bill today. Mr. Chair, we can continue to have conversations about how we're going to deal with this issue. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly, has the department identified how much money it costs to collect and transfer this fee?
Mr. Chair and Reverend Merkley, I'm not sure. I'm probably for the transfer, yes. The collection, it happens at the same time that we're issuing the driver's license. So it's not like you write me two different checks. You write a check to cover your driver's license.
A couple of follow-ups here. It seems potentially true, then, that the cost of collecting and transferring this fee is very small.
Mr. Chair and Reverend Berkeley, that's probably true.
Under the theory the department is putting forth, if a small portion of this $4 fee reimburses the department for the cost of collecting and transferring the fee, is the fee at that point legal?
Mr. Chair and Reverend Berkeley, it's my understanding, no.
Could you expound on this confusing point?
Mr. Chair and Reverend Berkeley, I cannot. I could have, you know, somebody from the Attorney General's office perhaps explain it better. It's a hard one for me to understand, other than when I've talked to the Assistant Attorney General, it's you're collecting a tax or excise, and according to the Constitution, when we collect a tax or excise, then it must be then go off to the highway fund. That's my understanding.
For the committee's knowledge, I think what we'll do is at some point, probably soon, as we have these bills, I'll have the Attorney General and Mr. Cutler from the Attorney General's office on a letter and the issues that surround it. Representative Devlin, did you have any
questions? Mr. Chairman, I think that would be very beneficial. I've been in some hearings before when they've looked at different things in terms of implementing them through a vehicle-related fee, and it appears that almost any time that you implement anything through a vehicle-related fee, it comes under the constitutional provision, and if you're making it a condition of utilizing the vehicle or having a license, that comes under the constitutional provision, and you want to use it for transportation, that's fine.
Representative Murphy, follow up.
I'm going to appreciate it if you provide us with a paragraph to this point, because the underlying premise that we've all had hammered into our heads is that this is premised on the use of highway funds. And if highway funds are not being expended to collect and transfer the fee because of the fee is paying for its own collection and transfer costs, I'd like to clarify how exactly this is interpreted to violate the Constitution.
Mr. Chair, Rivers Merkley, I'd be happy to get you some information on that.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosemore.
Thanks. Kelly, what is the lag time in between when these funds come in as part of renewals and when they're transferred?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenbaum, it's a monthly transfer, the following month.
Every month.
Yeah, yeah. As soon as we've closed out the book, so to speak, of the previous month, then the transfer happens. It's about mid-month.
So the language in the bill that has the emergency clause but says that funds that have been collected prior to that will be transferred as soon as practicable or something like that?
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenbaum, that's because this bill takes effect in July as far as, but monies that were collected in June truly are still supposed to head off to the Motor Vehicle Action Fund, but it gives us the ability to make that transfer happen in July, which is when it would happen.
So into the next biennium? Or?
Well, it's the very following month. I mean, it ends in June, so June's business is reconciled about the second week in July, and that's when the transfer would happen, and so it's only for that.
Okay. Thanks.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3064. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3066.
And John, would you see the snapshot of 3066?
Thank you, Chair Starr and members of the committee. You have before you House Bill 3066, which repeals the authority of Oregon Department of Transportation to distribute copies of the Motor Vehicle Code Book free of charge to anyone who is not an employee of the department. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2001. There is a minimal expenditure impact statement, minimal, and there is no revenue impact on this bill. Members, thank you, Chair Starr.
Kelly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. I want to make sure you all understand the vehicle code book is not the driver's manual that kids study with to get their license. We're not talking about that. This is the very thick, it's a booklet about, I meant to bring it, I'm sorry. It got so big, got so thick. It's the compilation of motor vehicle laws that DMV, motor carrier, and rail, et cetera, operate under. It's mostly under the 800 chapters of the ORS. And it is widely used throughout the department, courts, law enforcement, schools, government officials, hearings officers, you know, lots of people.
Representative Dillon.
Mr. Chairman, I have no problem with the bill, but could you get me a copy of the new one? I have one of the old ones.
Before the bill takes effect. Mr. Chair and Representative, sure, I'd be happy to. And so what the Attorney General has said is that we cannot, the law currently says we charge folks, except for we should give them to schools and government officials for free. That's what's really going to change. Everybody else is already paying for them. The fee is about $5 for the right now, and so that's what it's about.
Very good. We'll close the public hearing in House Bill 3066, and I'll open the work session in House Bill 3066. Representative Devins.
Move House Bill 3066 to the floor with two pass recommendations.
Representative Devins, move House Bill 3066 to the floor with two pass recommendations. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Actually, I think I'll have a roll call. I generally do that on those to the floor. So let's have a roll call, though.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Devins.
Aye.
Trapp.
Merkley. Clarification. Voting yes or no on sending this to the floor.
Aye.
Nelson.
Excuse.
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Turner.
Aye.
Shaw.
Aye. Bill passes. I'm tempted to put this on the consent calendar, except this will be the first bill that's going to come out in relation to the Attorney General's letter. So I think I will carry the bill, and it's a very simple one, but I think it's important for us to let the House know that these bills are coming. So I will carry the bill, and with that, we're done with our agenda, and there's an announcement. We're going to move our committee meeting starting time, starting next week, to 8:30. We're getting later into the session here. I know fourth session will be starting earlier on, so just mark your calendars, 8:30 starting next week.
Mr. Chairman, have you been given any word by the leadership on when they will start moving the session earlier?
I have not, but this is kind of my own self-prediction that that will happen. So, we can get our work done earlier and move ahead. So with that, we are adjourned.